Say goodbye to your credit card rewards. Greedy corporate mega stores, led by Walmart and Target, are pushing for a law in Congress to take away your hard-earned cash back and travel points to line their pockets. The Durbin-Marshall credit card bill would enact harmful credit card routing mandates that would end credit card rewards as we know it. If you love your credit card rewards, tell your lawmakers, hands off my rewards. Tell them to oppose the Durbin-Marshall credit card bill.
He and Will Forte are in this this one clip of a movie of a Hungry Hungry Hippos adaptation.
Welcome to Recotopia, a happy home for recommended movies, shows, and music from two people you can definitely trust. Trustability varies by region, no guarantees implied. Now, here are your hosts, Chris Atkinson and Jeremy Scott.
You the one killed our friend?
That's right. I shot the boy, too, and I enjoyed it.
Hey, everybody. This is episode 4 of Recotopia. I'm Chris Atkinson.
And I'm Jeremy Scott.
And welcome to all you lovely people out there in the chat who are joining us on Patreon. Love having you on the show and giving us some comments here and there.
Mm-hmm.
And today our big recommend is going to be Open Range.
Woo-hoo.
But before we get into Open Range, let's get into some of our smaller recommends. Jeremy, mm-hmm. Why don't you start us off?
It's no big deal.
Itty-bitty living space.
It's so small and light.
It's small. It's tiny. It's petite. It's wee.
Itty-bitty recommends. All right. Well, you may have seen some chatter this week on Twitter or other social media about Francis Ford Coppola making a statement about Marvel movies or mm-hmm. blockbuster films.
Mm-hmm.
And I can assure you, having read the full interview, that the absolute most mundane part of what he had to say is that shit about Marvel and blockbusters. It's really just a single paragraph in what I found to be an incredibly insightful interview.
Yeah.
I don't know if you've read it. It's on GQ.
I have.
He kind of bares his soul, really, in an impressive way. He tells this guy things he hasn't said before in other interviews. He talks about this movie he's trying to make, that he's been trying to make for 40 years, which sounds like it's either going to be incredible or a beautiful mess.
Mm-hmm.
But it's about love.
What is it called? It's like Megalopolis?
Megalopolis,
or something like
that.
Yeah.
Yeah. And he wants this to be a movie, much like It's a Wonderful Life, that mm-hmm. people watch annually and like discuss. And here's a quote I pulled. He says, on New Year's, instead of talking about the fact that you're going to give up carbohydrates, I'd like this one question to be discussed, which is the society we live in the only one available to us? And discuss it. He is very humble, I thought, for a man that doesn't have to be humble. And at the same time, he casually says, because he's funding this movie, $120 million of his own money. And he casually says, it's not like $120 million is all I've got. So mm-hmm. it's just very candid. He wanted to improve the ability of his vineyard to understand each grape individually, but they were being fermented all together. And so he built this ginormous underground system of 100 and some fermenters so he can hone in on which grapes are truly the best. Just a fascinating dude who's mm-hmm. lived a full life and has Hollywood stories. There's a bit in there where he's like, I turned down The Godfather at first. I never wanted to make The Godfather. I thought it was a really great read. Francis Ford Coppola on GQ's website. It's not paywalled or anything. And I love interviews like that that aren't just cookie cutter softball stuff, but where you really kind of feel like you get to know a person. So that's my first small recommend of the week.
Yeah. And since he doesn't have, I mean, he's got this movie he wants to make, but he doesn't have a movie that he's selling
right
in the interview. It gives them a chance to ask him questions about other things. He sounds exactly like how he's been described over the years, even though he takes a pot shot at that Easy Rider's Raging Bulls book.
Yeah.
Forgetting something about private jets wrong in it and everything. But everything I've ever heard about Coppola is like that it's, you know, he's got this way about him that tangent, he goes off on tangents, and you don't know exactly where he's coming from a lot of times. But I think that's exactly why a lot of those movies he made in the 70s are so good, is because he kind of has an idea of, he can see things that other people can't, and so on and so
forth. Yeah, I agree. He even said, I did not know this, he said he owns Apocalypse Now outright, because nobody wanted to make it. And he compared the way they looked at him then to the way they looked at him when he pitched this Megalopolis movie. So be curious to see what it looks like whenever he finishes.
Recommend that I'm gonna go with, I've been doing a lot of classics lately. So this one is actually from a while back that I watched, but I never got a chance to recommend it. You've all heard of this movie. So the movie's called Gaslight. It came out in 1944. It has Ingrid Bergman in it, Charles Boyer. It is about a woman who gets married to this man, and they move into what was her, I'm trying to remember if it was her mother's or aunt's old home. And during the course of them living in this house, Ingrid Bergman says that she hears things at night, and she has objects that mysteriously move around the house that she knows that she didn't move around the house, that her husband just ultimately says, none of this is happening. This is all in your head. This is, you know, this isn't real. She starts off, this is what sort of the tragedy of Gaslight is, that she starts off so happy, and she's completely normal and totally in love with this guy. And he seems equally in love with her, and they're at their happiest. But every time she says something that just sort of like, and we don't know exactly what this dude's deal is yet or why he's doing this. But every time she stumbles on something or sees something that's wrong or hears something that she thinks is wrong, he tells her that she's not, and he slowly breaks her down into this kind of a mess, as the movie keeps going further and further. And even when she thinks that she's better, and he's like, no, like every time she wants to go out, he's like, no, you can't go out. You're not well. Every time just basically says, no, you're not well. Even like in the very beginning, like just a little bit off, just maybe a tad bit off. And so he breaks her down methodically. Meanwhile, there's a detective played by Joseph Cotten who notices some things that are weird about their living arrangement and what's going on. The husband seems to go out at night and just takes walks or whatever. When she's by herself at her house, the gas light of the lights around the house and everything dims slightly, and she doesn't know what the reason is for that. And of course, anytime she brings it up, her husband's there, is like, that's not actually happening. Joseph Cotten finds out that there's definitely something going on wrong with this house, this couple. Something's off about this guy. He starts investigating. He starts digging into this guy's past, which a very intriguing past, by the way. And he starts to be suspicious of him, and he even follows him at one point where he's walking, and the guy just disappears, and he's like, where in the world is he going? And they kind of figure out that this guy is going back into the house. Why is he going back into the house? Well, I'll let you, the dear viewers of Gaslight, future viewers of Gaslight, find out what's going on here.
Mm-hmm. We got at least one there in JC Davis.
Yeah, JC. JC says, puts Gaslight on the list to watch. And yes, you cannot be disappointed by this movie. This movie is great all around. Ingrid Bergman's one of my all-time favorites, and this is one of her best performances I've ever seen. To see how much she breaks down during this is heartbreaking, because you know, you're like, the movie does kind of make you think maybe she is really like kind of crazy or something. Maybe she's not all the way there. I don't know what it is, but you will know pretty soon that you're like, wait a minute. I think this dude is, this dude's evil. I don't know what's going on, but this dude is evil. So now,
is this, I'll show my ignorance, is this where the phrase originates, gaslighting?
Yeah.
Oh, excellent.
Yes, this is exactly where it comes from. Don't know when people started using this as a verb, but it means exactly what the husband is doing to Ingrid Bergman in this movie, where she says that I see things and I hear things that she's obviously hearing and seeing, and then someone tells you that you're crazy for seeing or hearing those things. And that's why now it's become a huge thing, because we live in this disinformation, misinformation media and everything, and a lot of things that people see right in front of their eyes, people are denying, like, yes, you did, like you're crazy. So that's exactly where that comes from.
Excellent. Good to recommend. Man, this show is eclectic. I can't say that I'm part of the show. I'm going off prep. That's one of my favorite things to do. And I'm going to recommend a graphic novel combined book compendium thingy do. I don't know what they call it. Omnibus, I think, is what it's technically called.
Ooh, and it's, really?
And it's Batman Night of the Owls. Now, I have read this twice. Once a few years ago on a plane, and then once a few months back. What's neat about this one is that it runs, if you were buying all these issues as they came out, you would have had to buy issues of two separate Batman books, a Robin book, a Nightwing book, a Birds of Prey book, because the story ran through all of those books. And Night of Owls is about basically this court of owls, this shrouded society that for hundreds of years or more has controlled the fate of Gotham by pulling strings. And they were heretofore unknown to us, right? And they have assassins called Talons, who are basically badasses. And this Night of the Owls, a bunch of Talons attack Bruce Wayne in the Batcave, and he has to, like, defend his own home. Some go after Nightwing. Some try to assassinate a guy at Arkham. And so each of those characters I mentioned, right, Red Hood is even in this. They are all tracking down some lead or some assassin or following up some investigation, and it all culminates in some really interesting stuff. And I have a lot of Batman omnibus books. I'm a big Batman guy, but you don't often see the full Bat family in those. It's usually maybe you know, Batgirl's in, oh, she's in that too, Batgirl's in this. Maybe Batgirl will be in one, or Robin will be in one, but not the whole family trying to solve the same crime. So I really like it. And one of the reasons I wanted to bring it up is that I think there may be a little bit of this in the upcoming The Batman movie. In this particular story, there's some more exploring of Batman's ancestry, which I think this movie is going to do. Of course, this movie also looks like it has a lot of The Long Halloween in it, which is weird because The Long Halloween was heavily pulled from for The Dark Knight. So there's a lot of Batman stuff to pull, of course, but this is one that I really enjoyed, and you can probably find it on Amazon or your local comic shop.
You said it's an omnibus, so there's several different comics that are in this?
Yes, and artists. The main writer is Scott Snyder. He's relatively famous, and the main artist is Greg Capullo. I think one of the more famous DC artists. But there are dozens of writers and artists throughout this thing. So,
All right, great. It sounds awesome. I've read The Long Halloween, and I've read a few others, but not nearly as many as I probably should. So,
well, there you go. Another one to put on the list.
Yeah. My second smaller recommend is an Apple TV show called The After Party. Both Jonathan and Aaron were jumping all over this show and saying, you got to watch this. So, you know, took me a couple days to get through the 6 episodes that are currently available. The After Party, concerns an after party that comes after a 15-year high school reunion. Dave Franco is since they've last seen him in high school, he's become this huge pop star named Xavier. And there's a number of people in here, like Ivana Glazer, there's Sam Richardson, there's, Ike Barinholtz is in this. There's a million people that you've seen before, comic actors who were great. What's his name? Ben Schwartz is in this.
Oh yeah.
And so this guy, Xavier, the very beginning, very first thing in the episode is you hear, oh no. And then you see, Xavier fall to his death from the balcony of his house. And so, in comes Detective Tiffany Haddish, who, is, being told by her department, we don't want you to do too much investigating. We want this other guy that we're calling in to do it, but she's taking it upon herself to do all the investigating because she thinks this other guy is going to fuck everything up. So she's conducting interviews. And so every interview is, you know, if you want to talk about Rashomon type stuff and everything, every interview tells you a different perspective of the story, starting at the 15-year high school reunion and then going on to the after party. And everybody's got their own little stories from, what happens at the high school and what happens at the after party. Sam Richardson's in love with this one woman. He was in love with her in high school, but never got around to asking her out or anything. And then she ended up marrying Ike Barinholtz. And at the very moment that at this point in time, Ike Barinholtz has just been found cheating on her with Ivana Glazer. They're about to get divorced. And Sam Richardson thinks this is the time I'm going to finally get my chance with her. And her name's Zoe something. I've never seen her before. But she plays a character named Zoe too. How convenient. Every episode so far has been Tiffany Haddish gets one of the guests at the after party to tell their side of what's going on. And everybody's got this, you know, well, this is what was going on. And everybody's got like slightly different takes. And obviously, except for the Ben Schwartz one, which is an all musical one, pretty much. I mean, it's not all musical, but like he comes in, there's like two or three songs in the Ben Schwartz one. It's funny listening to the different lines that get said on everybody else's perspective. Like, you know, like Xavier has set up this big thing full of shrimp or something. At some point he calls it a prawn thing. Another time it's a shrimp thing. Another time, you know, it's like everybody's got a different take on what he said, you know, and that happens throughout it's what's probably going to be pretty good for rewatch value on this show, is that going back and sort of hearing what everybody says after the fact, after you've seen it for the first time. But so far this has not finished as of this recording. There's two more episodes left, so it's very funny. It's from Lord and Miller.
Oh, okay. Even better.
And yeah.
Buried the lead.
Yeah, I did bury the lead, didn't I? Lord and Miller are part of this. There's even some fun little cameos in the first episode where you see like Channing Tatum shows up in some movie. Dave Franco is a pop star, but he also acts. He and Will Forte are in this this one clip of a movie of a Hungry Hungry Hippos adaptation. It's really funny. It's got a lot of like, you know, just fun little gags in it and everything. So yeah, the after party is a lot of fun.
I feel like Apple TV's finally getting their content shit together, right? Like the first year or two out of the gate, they didn't have much that looked all that interesting or got that much buzz. And then Ted Lasso came along and started the whole thing. Of course, they had Coda, one of the bigger movies of the year, at least from awards perspective. Now they've got this show. Maybe they're getting their stuff together. All right.
There's another one that I want to see that they've been advertising for called Separation or it's something. It's a work thing.
Severance.
Severance. It has Adam Scott.
And Ben Stiller's directing that.
Yeah, yeah. It looks pretty good. And that's another one that I'm kind of interested in, kind of want to see.
Yeah, I saw that trailer and I thought, oh, this seems like a pretty cool episode of Black Mirror, but then shit starts going crazy. And well, maybe that's what Black Mirror is like too. But yeah, that's a series I'll have to check out.
Black Mirror, like I know you don't watch it, and I still feel like you should. Black Mirror is basically all about technology run amok,
yeah.
Like how technology fucks you in every chance. Like there's ways that people didn't think about, you know, that ends up fucking them by the end of the episode. It's Twilight Zone meets, you know, I don't know, Terminator or something.
Oh, okay.
So, it's not Terminator.
They should put that on the poster. Let's move on to the big recommend.
All right, everybody, it's time to talk about BetterHelp.
BetterHelp. Listen, have you ever had a conversation with a friend or a spouse or family member that was deep and educated you and went back and forth for a good long while. And you got done, and you were like, that was an excellent conversation. Usually when I have those experiences, I feel good afterwards. I feel better afterwards. And so the point I'm trying to make is that baseline, just talking to people is healthy for you. It's healthy for your brain. BetterHelp goes several steps beyond that by providing licensed professional therapists, usually in your area, and you can talk to them, and it's not just going to be shooting the breeze or having a deep conversation, because they are trained. They've gone to school for this. They have years of experience. They are trained to help you navigate your mental health issues and find ways to mitigate how those things impact your daily life. BetterHelp allows you to do this in any way you choose, by video chat, by phone, by text, by email. You can go into, you have your own little dashboard. You can send messages to your therapist. You can schedule your next session in there. And we have an offer for you from BetterHelp. If you go to betterhelp.com/recotopia, R-E-C-O-T-O-P-I-A, you can get 10% off your first month with the discount code RECOTOPIA. You just have to answer a few questions, and then they will help find the right therapist for you. There are different specialties in therapy. So these questions are designed to help, you know, them determine what kind of issues you're dealing with. Some people need marriage counseling. Some people need addiction counseling. Some people need therapy for depression or anxiety. And so, you know, answer these questions. They're not asking you super personal information. And then they're going to get you matched with a therapist, and you can get started right away. If you go to betterhelp.com/recotopia and use the discount code RECOTOPIA, you can get 10% off your first month and start getting help today.
I'm fine. It's just that you're so big.
It's so huge.
It's a good rule, but this is bigger than rules.
It's bigger on the inside.
Is it?
I noticed.
Yeah, so the big recommend this this week is Open Range. This is what Jeremy picked for us to watch this week. And this is a movie that I saw in theaters when I was working at the Hollywood 27, and I have not seen it until a couple days ago.
And what was your impression?
This movie is really good, and I'm going to say one thing that I think is bad about it.
Yeah, I have one
too. It's the Kevin Costner, Annette Bening thing.
Yeah.
Not believable whatsoever.
Well, I agree.
And then it takes too much time after that. It takes up a whole good section before a gunfight happens. And then after the movie is essentially over, it takes another like long time after that. If I could just cut those out.
Yep.
This movie solid, like 100% A+ movie.
And it's the least believable chemistry, because Costner and Duvall have so much chemistry in this movie. Mm-hmm. When he gets scenes alone with Annette Bening, it doesn't feel real to me. I don't feel like that chemistry is real. I actually wrote down, I'm not sure I need the marriage proposal stuff at the end. But I think you could cut everything about that romance. You can keep that character. She's important, especially at the end. Open Range, for those of you who didn't get a chance to watch it, it's about some free grazers, some people who are moving cattle from one place to another, but they just graze off the land. And this is frowned upon by people with money. There are some common...
I'm not familiar with the politics of this at all.
I am not either. Now, I know that Michael Gambon plays the local, you know, town rich man who bosses people around. That's kind of a Western trope, that there's a rich guy in town who owns the law and all that stuff. And he hates free grazers. And at one point he does say, get your cattle off my land. So I wonder if he does own the land that they're grazing on. And then you're dealing with a trespassing issue maybe. But this is also back in a time when not every chunk of land was owned by somebody. And it doesn't seem like such a big deal to me that somebody should let their cows eat some grass 3 miles outside of a city. No one's using that grass.
And I don't know, maybe this is something at the beginning I missed, but I didn't get the sense that they were upset about it until Abraham Ben Ruby goes back to get some supplies. So I didn't get the sense that anything was happening up until that point.
Right, because I don't think it is. I don't think the local baron, Gambon, I don't think he knows the free grazers are there until Ben Ruby comes into town. And then they jump him, beat him up, put him in jail. And so from there, they're like, well, we better go get our guy. He hasn't come back from town yet. And they get into town, and then that's when they get told off by basically the sheriff, who's corrupt. And he's like, don't take the free grazers here. Get your man. Get out of town. And keep on moving. Well, this is Robert Duvall, who, in my experience, largely only plays stubborn characters.
Indeed.
And he's a good-hearted dude. He's just an old cowhand, but he's not going to be told where he can and can't graze his cattle. So they go back out to their wagon, and there's also a kid with them, Button, they call him, and that's Diego Luna. So there are foursome of cattle drivers, but then there's some men in hoods over a ridge staring at them, and they go out to meet them, and the men run away, and that's when Duvall, whose name is Boss Spearman, says, I know men like Baxter my whole life. He aims to have this herd or scatter it to the wind. And so they decide they're going to sneak off in the middle of the night and jump these guys. And they do, and it's a freaking awesome scene because they absolutely humiliate and beat the shit out of these guys.
This scene, too, by the way, we often complain about scenes that are shot in close-up, in dark, and edited quickly, but there's something about this one, which has a lot of those same elements, that's done exactly right, and I don't know enough to say what it is, but it's like every time something happens, it feels right that action happens on screen.
Yeah.
At the very moment that they cut to it. It's a very well put together scene. I feel like this is one that that Kevin Costner probably like really, really like made sure was good before it got sent out.
Oh,
and
yeah.
That one, it's excellent.
Oh, yeah. And Costner, if we didn't mention, is the director here as well as one of the two stars. And I meant to open with, there are three kinds of Costner movies I will always be up for watching. Westerns, sports movies, and movies where he plays a serial killer who has an imaginary friend.
Yes.
So while they're jumping these guys in the woods, unfortunately, some other bad guys are jumping Button and Mose, who's Ben Ruby, back at the wagon. So Costner and Duvall race back. And they find that Mose Ben Ruby is dead. The dog is dead because only bastards shoot dogs.
That's
and
right.
They have shot Button, who's a kid. I believe at one point they call him a 16-year-old kid.
I'm not sure if he's still like. I think they find him when he's 16 because apparently it's like when he was eating stuff out of dumpsters or whatever. Yeah. They found him around. That's where they find him. But yeah, he is young, no matter what.
Yeah, and so and the wagon is all ransacked and busted, and you know, first things first, they take the kid to go see the doctor. There's a doctor that lives just outside of town. That's where Annette Bening keeps falling in love with Costner. But this is where momentum starts to build. I said last episode, this is a slow burn. Like, you know, from this point, at this point, you know, there's going to be a big fight at the end of this movie. But I enjoy the skirmishes along the way where they shout down the sheriff in the diner and they go outside and they're having this argument because Costner had an idea and Duvall didn't like it. And then Duvall changes the subject and goes, how do you like my speech in there? Costner goes, liked it. they end up in a bar where they order a couple of shots. And the bar is owned by Baxter, the town baron. So the bartender refuses to serve them and they go ape on him. Costner throws a glass down the length of the bar that smashes in the bartender's ear. And then he ultimately has to pull out a shotgun and shoot the no free grazers sign. And then he goes, now we'll have our drinks.
Yeah.
there's a lot of great line delivery in here. And it's written, you know, real folksy cowboy-like. And then they do the ballsiest thing I think I've ever seen anybody do in a Western like this. They go straight to the sheriff's office because they find out his men are waiting to kill him. And they take the sheriff prisoner and put him in jail and chloroform his ass. And then when those dudes come back, they chloroform their asses and put him in jail. That all leads to what is, I think, one of the best gunfights in any Western I've seen, at least any modern Western. It goes on for about 25 minutes.
Yeah.
There are moments at, right after it starts for about 6 minutes. It's the Wild West version of the shootout in Heat after the bank heist.
Yeah.
In terms of everything is staged very well. Watching it this time, I was really impressed with the continuity in both this scene, but with the town, because the town floods in the middle of the movie.
I was about to bring this up.
And then later it's muddy and still wet, and the building that fell in the flood is still falling over.
Yeah.
And I read on Wikipedia, they built this town from scratch because Costner wasn't pleased with any of the existing Western towns that they could have used. And had to build a 40-mile road, just or $40,000 on a road just to get to the filming location. That's how remote it was. And they built this whole entire town out there. What did you want to say about the flood?
Well, that was exactly what the exact thing that you brought up that I actually laughed, and not because it's inherently funny. It's just that early on in the movie, they're trying to get into this cafe, and they have a big, huge like puddle of water that's in front of the thing, and they put a little plank down so that they can walk over it. And so Duvall gets over the plank, and then the plank falls into the water and they can't retrieve it, and Kevin Costner has to get like all of his feet soaked walking into the cafe. But the board comes down and starts slamming up against that part that's getting built, and then we suddenly just see it like kind of fall to the side. And he says something to the effect, "Well, don't be building your buildings in mud then," or something like that. And you totally forget about this building until it's time for the gunfight, and there's somebody just walking past that building in the background. You can still see it tilted. Yeah. And you know, it would have been something that if it was upright, you wouldn't have asked any questions whatsoever, because you would have thought, they must have gotten it back upright. Right. The fact that it's still down is not only real to probably what you, I mean, I don't know what you would do in that situation. You have to probably rebuild.
Yeah,
probably.
Yeah. You probably have to tear it down.
But it's just sort of a matter of fact detail that he throws in there that I just kind of laughed out loud when I saw it.
The shootout goes on for a really long time. It's really well paced. It's really well staged. I feel like the townsfolk creeping in to the end of the battle is done in a non-cheesy way,
mm-hmm.
where like a temptation there would be to have them all stand up and I am Spartacus one at a time, and that, you know, like at the end of Bug's Life or whatever, but that was an odd comparison, but
it's an apt one.
Instead, they're kind of, you see Michael Jeter kind of creeping, and the general store owner's kind of creeping with the guns the whole time.
Yeah.
Getting closer and closer. I just think the whole thing is very satisfying as a Wild West shootout is concerned. There's even elements of humor, if you can call it humor, when he walks up and says, "Are you the guy that shot our friend?" He's like, "Yeah, I shot the boy too, and I liked it." And boom, he's dead.
Yeah.
Costner shoots that guy. They spent the whole movie building this guy up as this badass gun hand. And that's another thing. I'm sorry, I love this movie, so I'm probably a little
weird.
I appreciate that the movie gives us sort of an explanation for why some people are way better at aiming their guns than others. Like Costner is a former gun hand and basically a sniper. And and same with this guy that they kill, Kim Coates. He's, a gun hand, but he goes on this little tick where he's like, then the next group will be probably ex-army, maybe former police. They're not going to be quite as good a shot. The final group will just be cowhands. They're not going to stand and fight. They're going to run. And so when the gun battle is happening and some bullets are hitting and some bullets are missing, there's an explanation for it. It's not just like we're stormtroopering so that the heroes can stay alive. And also the heroes get shot a couple times too. So,
yeah.
I love everything about it. I love the relationship between those two men, how it feels like there's such a history there. I'm going to stop rambling and let you ramble a little bit now.
It's a different kind of Western. I mean, it's got the same elements of any other, like there's going to be a shootout in this town, at the crack of dawn, high noon type movie. You know, we know Westerns, how they go about it. And usually, either have someone corrupt running the town that everybody hates and that, but nobody has the power to stand up against. And you have good guys who show up who want to fight those people later on, or you have some other kind of, I think High Noon, it's bad guys who used to run the town are coming back to, the town to fight. And Gary Cooper ends up being like, okay, well, we can't let this happen. We're going to have to kill those fools. I remember Gary Cooper saying that we got to kill those fools. This one's a little bit different because these are two guys who are minding their own business, have no intention of being in this town whatsoever. And when they get in the town, there's no real sense that they're under the thumb of somebody oppressive. Maybe it's the very beginning of something being oppressive. There's a couple of people here and there who are like, we don't really care about the free grazing thing right. that he does. So maybe it's just the very beginnings of a town that's eventually going to be like something like this, you know, like something that's going to be a real corrupt town. But this one, you know, it was kind of refreshing to see this because it doesn't follow to a T what every other shootout Western does, which is there's definitely somebody bad and everybody hates this person and they can't stand up to him. And then you have to have two or three good guys come in and make sure that justice prevails by the end of it. So this is a little bit different from most Westerns that you've seen. It's got the same elements. I mean, it ends up the same way by the end, mm-hmm. but I enjoy that there's a little bit of a difference here. I don't know if Kevin Costner intended to make it like this town, there's not anybody like really just upset about Michael Gambon being in this, being their leader, essentially. I don't know if he meant for it to be that way. Maybe we're supposed to see that this is an oppressive place to live. But I like the fact that it's a little bit different from that. It's not completely there yet, at least. I like to look at it that way, that it's in the beginnings of that, and it's not towards the end where we usually see these right. Westerns.
Jeffrey says he remembers they put that Costner shooting Coates moment in the trailer. that apparently sold him on the movie. That moment is, you know, reminiscent to me of the Indiana Jones moment where
yeah.
the guy does all the sword stuff and he just shoots him. Or even Young Guns, where Emilio Estevez is like, hey, I see you got Bobby Scheister or whatever his name is out there with you. And he goes, shoots him.
Yeah.
Hey, you don't got him anymore.
But
I hope Young Guns 2 is not like, I hope I just didn't ruin your super secret double feature.
No, you didn't. There's no way. I'll just tell you right up front. There's no way in fuck you could have ruined my double feature.
Excellent. Excellent news. Then I will go ahead and say the shootout at the end here reminds me and rivals the shootout at the end of 310 to Yuma. Which is also fantastically staged and shot and lasts a long time and stretches throughout a whole town. I love the folksy language. I mentioned it before, but right before they go into the battle, they're hiding behind their wagon, and Costner forgets that he has this chocolate in his pocket. He takes it out, and it's all melted. And Duvall's laughing at him, and Costner goes, good is good, melted otherwise. And he starts putting his finger in it. The movie is littered with those kind of interactions. It just feels genuine to me, like this is how people would really talk. Anything else we want to say about Open Range before we move into the super secret double feature?
I don't know. We already discussed the Annette Bening romance thing that doesn't make any sense. And when I say they could cut it, I honestly think they could cut it out. Like you wouldn't have any remnants of that at all if you just cut in certain spots.
Right, you wouldn't have to reshoot the thing. Yeah.
Right, because there's some points where they just think that she and the doctor are married, and it's only brought up later on at the bar that she's that guy's sister. And then they spend the night at the doctor's place, and it's only after they leave that Duvall says, you can't leave her like this. And I'm sitting there going, yeah, you can. Yeah, you can. You can leave her right now. There's nothing between you two at all.
Nope.
And I was sitting there thinking, you could cut it just when he leaves her and says, well, goodbye or whatever. They can just cut right to the next thing. And then they can cut out the ending.
Yep.
They can cut out the whole ending of it where after they're done with the fight. I mean,
yeah.
You could still have her riding in the on a horse with them later or something. I don't know. But
yeah,
you don't even need that.
No, I mean, you could once the fight is over, I think you can be done. And yeah, I don't even need to see Boss and Charlie riding off to let's go get our cows. And then it kind of goes slow-mo as it fades to black. And I'm like,
mm-hmm.
All right. Yeah, all right.
Yeah.
So, yeah, I agree. There's some bloat there. Unnecessary storylines, perhaps. But it doesn't keep me from wanting to watch this movie over and over again. That final gunfight is worth the whole thing for me. But
yeah.
You almost need most of that slow burn up to it for that to really pay off. It's like I could watch the shootout in the middle of Heat after the heist if I want, and it'd be cool. But all the stuff that leads up to it makes it even cooler and more tense.
Well, I'll say where they could have continued the slow burn and just cut out the Annette Bening stuff is they could have, okay, if the fight is taken here, we will go and they just take you through the town and all the different places that they could end up.
Yeah.
And they sort of map it out for you. This is something that's just woefully missing from most movies, in my opinion. Mm-hmm. Maybe it's just me that, you know, a movie. Now this movie does kind of give you what's the 411 on everything, right? It kind of tells you, all right, we need to go back here where there's more guns and all that.
Right.
But I feel like there's a lot of movies out there that just want to like surprise you and be like, we don't want anybody knowing about that because that's a surprise. Well, a lot of times it's way more interesting to know what's going on before they spring something on you and you're like, how'd they do that?
Yeah.
And I hate that. So anyway, funny in the, are we ready for the double feature?
Let's do the super secret double feature.
Be very, very quiet.
Secret? What secret?
Our dirty little secret.
I tell you something I've never told anyone.
The super secret double feature, we're ready to do that. What's funny to me is that JC mentioned Lock, Stock, and Two Smoking Barrels, which is not my double feature, but it was considered.
Ah.
It was highly considered.
Ah.
The main reason why Lock, Stock, and Two Smoking Barrels is considered is because it is a bunch of people who are getting in on a situation that they don't realize. They don't realize a lot of the things that are going on in the, they're kind of innocents. In a way, they're not really innocents. They're trying to steal money, but like it's they're trying to steal dope and money, I think. But there's a lot of like different interested parties that are all getting involved in Lock, Stock, and Two Smoking Barrels, and they just happen to get like it's this movie is awesome. I love that. I would imagine this is going to be a full recommend episode one day.
Oh yeah,
is Lock, Stock. They do seem to be kind of accidentally into some of the situations that they run into. And that kind of relates to Open Range and mm-hmm. the fact that they're, you know, these two people are walking through and they don't have any idea that there's somebody out there who's like free grazing. I'm again it,
yeah.
You know, there's nobody like that. But the movie that I have double featured with this and, believe me, there's a million westerns that go along with this, like Martin Lynn Lewis or whatever you want to call it. And it goes perfectly well. I'm not gonna, you know, be upset if someone came up with a western just for Open Range because that's what you're gonna do. My double feature is Trespass. The 1992 movie starring Bill Paxton, William Sadler, Ice-T, Ice Cube, and a host of other people from Die Hard, like Devereaux White, who played Argyle, is in that.
Oh, wow.
William Sadler, of course, the bad guy, Die Hard 2. The guy who played the janitor or whatever is of Die Hard 2 plays a homeless guy in Trespass. At first, you're going to be like, huh? How does Trespass in any way relate to this movie? I'll tell you how. They're William Sadler and Bill Paxton are firefighters who at the very beginning of the movie are putting out this blaze, and there's a guy that they're trying to save who's really remorseful about something he did many years ago. he stole a whole bunch of artifacts from a Catholic church and he stashed them away somewhere in East St. Louis, Illinois, in an apartment building or a building that was turned into an apartment building or something like that.
Hmm.
Bill Paxton investigates it and is like, oh, wow, there could be actual like real gold artifacts buried in this abandoned apartment building in East St. Louis. Meanwhile, there's another story going on with Ice-T, Ice Cube. They see somebody on a video killing one of their own, and they want to settle the score with that guy in their territory, but somewhere where cops won't be anywhere around just so happens to be this apartment building where this treasure is going to be found. So Paxton and Sadler go from Arkansas to East St. Louis to find this treasure, and they go up into this one room where there's the guy drew a map of where this is supposed to be. They have a metal detector, all this, and then suddenly they start hearing conversation outside, and like there's some shit going down, and the guy gets thrown, the guy that that Ice-T wants dead gets thrown down this like a whole bunch of stories of the building, and after he falls through the building, guess what? Bill Paxton's there and Ice-T sees him. Ooh. and he gets accosted by all the I guess they're gangsters, but they get upset when they're called gangsters in this, but they're gangsters.
Yeah, I think so.
And William Sadler comes in and saves Bill Paxton and kidnaps what Ice-T considers his brother. And there's a standoff inside this one room. They can't go in the room because they don't. Ice-T has all this affection for this guy that got stolen. That's got stolen, kidnapped. It's Devereaux White, the Argyle from Die Hard.
Okay.
So there's this sort of back and forth type of thing. Do they find the treasure? I'm going to leave that up to you.
Ooh.
Do they find the treasure or not? Are they able to get out with the treasure? So this standoff is really cool. There's a lot of like, sort of like, you know, there's a lot of smart stuff going on back and forth here. Like, you know, they want to escape, but the gangsters always have somebody in place in wherever they are. Glenn Plummer, by the way, pre-speed Glenn Plummer, is pre-showgirls Glenn Plummer is a sniper that they've got set up just outside one of the windows. So if they try to go out the windows, they're fucked, and they can't go out the door because that's where the gangsters are. And like, this movie is really good. I don't know, 6.3 on the IMDb. I'm a little disappointed in you voters on the IMDb for giving this a 6.3 total aggregate. The comparison between these two is more stark when it's towards the middle part of the movie, and Ice-T is asking them why they're here, asking Bill Paxton and William Sadler why they're here. And once they start, I don't know if Ice-T ever gets wind of it. Some people never get wind of the fact that there might be gold in there, but some people do, and they're like, this is our territory, that's our gold. It doesn't matter if you came in here to look for it and nobody knew about it. That's our stuff, that's our territory. And that's what's the open rangy about this, it's two people who have absolutely nothing to do with these gangsters whatsoever, walk in on their territory unknowingly, and they try to accomplish something that it ends up being, hey, this is these gangsters' gold, if you really want to put a fine point on it.
Mm.
And then of course there's a big shootout at the end. So there you go.
Yeah. JC says I clicked the wrong one. JC says the real treasure was the friends we made along the way.
Well, isn't it always?
Yeah.
I feel like this happens in most movies.
Yeah.
It's the friends we make
I
along
agree.
The way.
All right. Yeah. Now, it's time to give out some homework for next week's big recommend, and that is Chris's call this week. And what do you have for us?
We're going to do Jackie Brown.
Ooh.
Pamela Greer is Jackie Brown. If you've ever seen those, you ever seen those trailers? I remember getting so excited about this movie just based on the teaser trailers where they just Quentin Tarantino kept on saying, Pam Grier is, and then she comes down to the lock and says, Jackie Brown, and then Pam Grier is, and it's a different reading. And then he goes, Pamela Grier is Jackie Brown. And you see it in the movie. It's a brief shot of her going to the lock and going, Jackie Brown.
Oh,
the live chat for that one will be March 1st. For an episode that will be released on March 7th to the general public.
There you go.
Okay. So then we can talk about this, right?
I think so.
Okay. All right.
Yes.
So we're going to do something different. After that episode, Jeremy and I are going to watch The Batman on March 9th. And then we're going to do a show for it. On that following the 14th, that'll be the live show for that. And then it will come out on the 22nd. That will be the, right?
Yes. I think you're correct.
I could be wrong about that too. Oh, no. No, we were doing this. Yeah, I think that's right. Either way, once we get there, we'll get there. But we're going to do to the Batman and after that. But the next one will be Jackie Brown, and definitely start watching that early. It's a it's like a little under 3 hours. So,
yeah.
But I swear to God, it's a really quick.
Oh man, it moves. It moves.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Let's get into some questions.
Question.
I got something to say.
I want the truth.
I'm listening.
All right. So we're going to start with a question we got via email. We got a lovely email from a listener, and there are three criteria for this question. It's like a quiz show. You can take the third part first if you want.
Right.
What movie makes you cry the most? What was the first movie that made you cry? Which movie made you cry most recently?
Now, I don't know if I cried when I first watched this movie, but I would say that at this point, it's probably the movie that has made me cry the most, and it's Dead Poets Society, because...
Ooh.
There are two things in this movie that can make you cry. It's weird to me that there are people out there. I think Roger Ebert was one. And I even saw a YouTube thing where they think Dead Poets Society is trash for some reason. And I don't know why that is. I guess to each his own, but I'm surprised that it takes, you know, people have takes like that. Anyway, Dead Poets Society has two major moments, and as I've gotten older, especially like at the very end, everybody's doing the "Oh Captain, My Captain" thing, and that part always gets me. That these guys would, you know, risk expulsion to tell their teacher goodbye in this dramatic way at the end. The first movie that may have made me cry, and I don't mark these things down, but I feel like I teared up in Glory when Denzel Washington is getting whipped in that scene. Ooh, and Jesus. he just stares at the camera essentially, while that's happening. I don't know if Denzel Washington may not have been as huge as a star as he was when that movie came out. I seem like I knew him though, even then when I was 12 years old. Mm. But like, I believe that was one of his first really big, like he'd been doing stuff throughout the decade, obviously. And he was on what, General Hospital or St. Elsewhere. That one for sure. And the most recent one is Coda. Coda's got that couple of scenes in it too that make you tear up. So yep.
Well,
yeah.
And my answer for most recent is Coda as well. Mostly because we reviewed it on this, we talked about it on this podcast a couple weeks ago. That movie's probably always going to get me at the end. The first one that ever made me cry is probably, I honestly don't remember. I'm sure I was 5 or 6 or 7. I'm guessing it was either Old Yeller. I know I cried at Wrath of Khan when Spock died. The first time I saw that, I would have been 6 or 7 when that movie came out. Mm-hmm. And then the one that makes me cry the most is About Time with Donald Gleason.
Oh, yeah.
Where he can go back in time. And there's a father-son relationship in that movie that well, it just hits me in the right feels. And when that final shot of them, they have one last moment together, and he's like, well, what should we do? And it cuts back to them running on the beach like when he was a little boy. And buckets of tears just come out every time I see that one. All right, let's move on to another question.
All right.
What is the best film score from the last 2 to 3 years?
You know, the one that stood out to me the most is If Beale Street Could Talk.
I remember you saying that.
Yeah, it came out in 2018, but it's still basically a three-year-old movie at this point. But that one, for some reason, that one was particularly affecting. I know that Jackie also had a pretty good score in it as well. But If Beale Street Could Talk is the one that there's something magical about that score for me. That just stood out among all the noise that you hear. Like, I don't really notice scores until, like, you know, until they're, like, really, really, really good. And so that one just stood out to me.
Yeah. Good call. I'm going with Power of the Dog, a friend of the show.
Yeah.
Which was really unsettling. You know, sometimes a score is moving, uplifting, evocative of other emotions, but this one is like anxiety inducing in all the best ways. Sometimes it's just noises that are going on in the background, but I noticed it both times I watched. I noticed how much that was adding to my own experience of anxiety for the sake of the characters, not my clinical anxiety. I thought that was a really effective score.
By the way, not that the final season of Game of Thrones is anything really to be happy about whatsoever, but the score that went on throughout that season was really good. I remember being really amped and excited for that, but like everything else, I was like, what? Huh? What was this? What was this all about?
Right. I like this question. Do you own any physical movie media that you cherish more than the quality of the film would suggest due to personal connections or memories?
Yeah, and there's that caveat that's in this question that makes it harder for me to answer.
Screw the caveat.
Yeah, I know, but I answered this. I answered Back to the Future. It's the very first VHS that I owned. Back to the Future, and I proceeded to watch the movie every day for 2 weeks, including like twice in some days watched Back to the Future because I had VHS. And I think this was the movie came out in 85. I think I got the cassette in either late 86 or 87. And I watched it every day. You know, there are of course a lot of movies now that I buy very mechanically. I hate to say I buy them like, oh, that's available. Okay, I got it.
Sure.
And so like stuff that I own now, it's hard. But you know, if you want to go back into those VHS Laserdisc days, that's going to be the biggest one. I guess Pink Floyd, The Wall. The movie is like not the greatest in, you know, it's abstract. It's got great Pink Floyd music obviously in it, but I've never been a big fan. I don't think the movie is like super great, even though I think it's very highly rated on the IMDb. But I would probably prize that one, as if you wanted to go in with the caveat, just more than usual, because I used to play that tape a bunch. Even though I wasn't a big fan of the movie, it's the music and what, you know, that I was a big fan of. So,
all right. I'm going to give you three answers because why not? I still have a VHS, of Muppets Take Manhattan that I recorded off of television. There's no movie I've seen more in my life than this, because there was a 4 or 5 year period where I put this in probably every other day. It became like a security blanket to me. I would come home from school and pop it in. but also, there was this time in my life right after my wife and I first got married where we didn't have cable, and I did not own a lot of DVDs or Blu-rays or anything. I just didn't have a collection at that time. I hadn't really started buying DVDs. And I had I Am Legend. and The Dark Knight. And because Over the Air was such poor quality reception, it was more fun to put in a movie than it was to those two and Finding Nemo. I probably, in 2 year period when we didn't have cable, I probably watched those three movies 40, 50 times each. And I still have all of those DVDs, even though I don't use DVDs anymore.
Mm-hmm.
DVDs.
That's a huge part of watching those movies, right? When you don't have cable or any other sort of distractions, those are always go-to. And this used to be my thing. Like if I didn't have, I mean, I used to pop in movies all the time because I didn't either didn't have cable or there was nothing on cable that I particularly liked or watched or anything. So, totally.
All right. I'm going to do one last question and then we're going to wrap it up. What are some of the worst character names in movies?
Okay, so I know a lot of people love this name for a variety of reasons. But I've always thought that this is just a stupid name, and it's too in your face. Pussy Galore is just a terrible name, and I'm pretty sure that when I first heard it, I probably laughed. But like, it's just, come on, even for Bond, this is just too much. This is just too much. And so I've never really liked this, but I know people are fans of it. Also in the movie Lolita, of course, in the book as well, Humbert is the name of the main guy in that. And I find that extremely dumb and stupid, but, as my namesake, Chris Batkinson says, Castor and Pollux Troy, is a definitely horrible, horrible name.
All right.
Sure.
I wrote down two, Aurora Lane in Passengers. It's the kind of name that will never sound real. In the world, there probably are dozens of girls named Aurora Lane, but that is a street, in a subdivision with cookie cutter houses. That is not a woman's name.
Right.
You can have Aurora and then like Mitchell, like a normal last name, or you can have like Susie Lane and have that be the last, but you can't have Aurora and Lane, or you've just gone into like children's storybook names. The other one I wrote down was Cho Chang from Harry Potter, which, as I understand it, is the least Chinese sounding name and is somewhat borderline, maybe subconsciously racist. Well, but just because it's racist to make Asian sounds.
Right.
You know what I'm saying? Right?
Yeah.
The thing that The Rock did that goes on Twitter every now and then. And that's what this name sounds like to me. It sounds like somebody doing a bad imitation of a Chinese person. Anyway, that's a terrible name, regardless.
Well, let me go over some of the chat's names too, real quick.
Oh, yeah, please do. I'm sorry.
Christmas Jones. That's another Bond. The world is not enough. Cole Trickle from Days of Thunder. That, I actually thought of that one at one point, but it sounded so much like other NASCAR drivers I was like, this sounds actually pretty good. Johnny Rico from Starship Troopers, Dewey Cox, Long Duck Dong. Oh my God.
Oh,
16 Candles. I think 16 Candles. Memphis Reigns in Gone in 60 Seconds. And then you have Kingsley Shacklebolt in Harry Potter as well. There's a lot of bad ones for sure. Now we're going to wrap this up.
All right. So homework for next week. Jackie Brown.
Pamela Greer is Jackie Brown.
And we thank you all for joining us here in the live chat. I do believe that adds an element of fun, but also content to the show. And we will see you on what did we decide? The first for our next live recording.
First is our next one. Yeah, first is our next live recording.
All right.
See you guys then. It's been great. Thank you very much.
Bye.
Be a part part of the live show by being a member of the Sin Club at Patreon at patreon.com/cinemasins. Chat with us on the CinemaSins Discord at discord.gg/cinemasins or CinemaSins Twitter at CinemaSins, and email any comments or questions to recotopia@cinemasins.com. That's recotopia@cinemasins.com.
And
my flippy floppies.
And my flippy floppy, a blippy dippy doppy. It's the 1 year anniversary, not to the day, but they're playing the golf tournament that they were playing when Tiger Woods wrecked his car and jacked up his leg.
Oh.
And he's the host of this tournament. And he is again this year. And he gave a pretty grim outlook at the press conference. Like, he said, I can chip and putt pretty well, but the long shots aren't as easy, and there's no way I could walk a golf course right now.
I imagine things don't extend as far as they used to, as far as like a trying to get rear back for a drive and all that. I mean, how many things do you use when you make a drive? It's like every part of your body almost.
He said there was a time where they were thinking amputation. And he's just happy to have his leg. And I'm like, well, that's great, but I need to play golf again. I was just reading about somebody today, and they were exactly my age. Oh, Leonardo DiCaprio.
Yeah.
And I was like, no. He and I are not that age. We're both in our early 30s.
If you want to have something over DiCaprio, you're a year younger than he is. But
oh well,
I don't know if a whole calendar year younger, but he was born in 74, I believe.
Oh, that's great. I just saw the number. It said 46, and that's my age.
Yeah.
So
yeah, he'll be 48 this year.
Yeah, fuck him. It really is. Adjustment Bureau. I tweeted once that I had seen it twice and I couldn't remember it, and I was making a joke that I had been adjusted, but people were like, no, that movie is just super forgettable. And I'm like, well, that's it. That's why my joke didn't land, but yeah.
That's right. That's when you pull out the McBain meme. That's the joke.
That's the joke.